From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, those open lines. And this hour, one of my favorite topics, the Twilight Zone. So get ready for that. Okay, daylight saving time ends Sunday at 2 a.m. So just before you go to bed Saturday night, turn those clocks back 1 hour. Spring ahead, fall back. Here's what's happening. The government has released more than 600 previously classified documents now connected to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. They came out today. The new batch, which follows a release of thousands of others related documents last week, shows that the CIA learned about assassin Lee Harvey Oswald's connection to the agency and why he had visited Mexico City only weeks before. Though what the CIA has described as a thorough investigation, the allegations that Oswald was somehow connected to or working with the agency, they say, totally unfounded. I don't agree with that. A 1975 memo, CIA memo, showed that the agents searched through all their records to see if they could find any conceivable way that Oswald would somehow have been connected to them. More on these stories will be coming out, of course. And don't forget our JFK special in a couple weeks. A new anti-fascist group plans a rally Saturday in downtown Portland, part of a series of scheduled across the country. But the demonstrations have whipped up warnings for months by right-wing groups on social media that the gatherings could be start of a civil war. I don't think that's going to happen. And a big story that has been going around the internet for several weeks now, a rumor claiming that the national power grid will be knocked out for several days is causing panic on social media. That is fake news. The rumor is false. William Forstchen, who wrote the book, of course, One Second After, about what could happen if the power grid goes down, he's on with us right now. Bill, have you heard about this story, too?
Absolutely. I was at a conference, a lot of FBI folks down in Dallas only a month ago, and we were chatting about this, and yeah, there was anxiety that it would be misinterpreted as some sort of what, black swan or false flag operation. It's simply a simulation test.
Where's the test going to be? Do we know?
It's nationwide. They're linking in with, interestingly, ham radio operators, something I know that you're interested
yep.
in, to create a communications grid if the standard primary grid goes down.
Well, we've been talking about this for years now, William. What's the latest on that with legislation? Are we getting any closer to getting the grid fixed?
Oh, George, don't trigger
Please.
Me into a Tourette syndrome moment.
No
progress. Gridlock. We have a gridlock Congress. There was a bill earlier this year, died in committee.
All right, Bill. Thank you so much. Have a good weekend. Well, more bad news for Sears. Sears Holdings will close 63 more stores. That includes 45 Kmart stores, 18 Sears stores around the country. The company operates roughly 1,250 Sears and Kmart locations. Retail, it's turning to the internet for so many things. What else is going on these days? Let's check in with the skies of Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Hey, Peter, what do you have this week?
Well, good evening, George, and I preface by saying that I hope sincerely that some of the reports that have been reported to me that I'm going to be talking about tonight are cases of mistaken identity, because if they're not, they're chilling descriptions of very, very unusual events. First case I'd like to start with comes from the 21st of October, 13 days ago. A gentleman who describes himself as a retired former senior officer in the U.S. Air Force was driving southwest of Winston-Salem, North Carolina. They were headed home to Hickory, North Carolina, when suddenly ahead of them, a triangular, the officer describes it as an isosceles triangle, a triangle with two equal sides, lime green with intensely bright lights on the three corners, suddenly appeared ahead of their car, probably within a mile, he estimates, and just hovered there motionless for a fraction of a second. It suddenly accelerated, went down, went up, and then disappeared in the western sky. That report is now posted and highlighted on our website, our homepage. I hope people will enjoy that one, a very nicely prepared report from a qualified witness. And his son, a graduate student, was with him. They both saw and reported the very same thing. Very interesting report. Two nights later, the 23rd of October, a former science teacher was driving near Sherman, Texas, just north of Dallas, right on the Oklahoma border. As he was driving on Highway 75, he looked ahead of his car, and there was a very peculiar-looking cloud, the shape of a flying saucer. So it attracted his attention. Suddenly, it started moving to his left, that is, to the east. It did a right-angle turn to the south, started ascending, and suddenly accelerated and just disappeared quickly in the southern sky. Very, very nicely prepared report. The 26th of October, that is, that was a Thursday, I believe, a week ago, a gentleman was riding on an airliner from Atlanta to Minneapolis. He, too, is a military person, currently in uniform. He looked out the right side of his aircraft, I guess generally to the north. He saw a dark black, charcoal black, triangular craft streaking towards the aircraft that he was seated on. It was below their flight level. He estimates it was about 1,000 feet below them. And he later revised his report and said he thought that it was somewhat similar to the Phantom Ray drone that is manufactured by Boeing, but he's unclear on whether it was or not. I thought I would include it in my report because I thought the Coast listeners would like to know that we either have UFOs or we have unmanned drones flying at 30,000 feet,
that's right,
mixing with commercial airplanes. Last two reports I'll touch on briefly. A report tonight from Orlando, Florida. I talked with the gentleman who submitted it, a very sane and sober guy. He saw 50 tiny white lights in the night sky in a cluster moving to the south. I mention it principally because just 20 minutes before this program, I got a very similar report from Walnut, California, down in your neck of the woods in the Los Angeles Basin. So you're right. There's a lot going on, George. We just posted 222 reports to the website. I hope Coast listeners will enjoy reading them.
We'll talk to you next week. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. The Twilight Zone is an American television anthology series created by Rod Serling. The episodes are in various genres, including fantasy, science fiction, suspense, psychological thrillers, often concluding with a macabre or unexpected twist, usually with a moral. A popular and critical success, it introduced many of us to common science fiction and fantasy topics. The original series, shot entirely in black and white, ran on CBS for 5 seasons from 1959 to 1964. In a moment, Stephen J. Rubin joins me with the Twilight Zone Encyclopedia, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Author Steve Rubin began his career as a journalist and motion picture publicist and has worked on more than 150 films and television series. Steve's latest work is this book we're going to talk about tonight, The Twilight Zone Encyclopedia, giving insight into this amazing program. And Carol Serling, Rod Serling's wife, says this monumental book is required reading for all devotees of The Twilight Zone. What a great line. And Stephen, welcome to the program. I'm looking forward to this.
Oh, thank you, George. And it's such an honor to be on your show. I've always been a listener, and you bring a breath of fresh air to the airwaves every night.
Well, thank you so much. I love The Twilight Zone. I have loved it since I was a kid. I love it now. I just can't seem to get enough of it. We've had Billy Mumy on the show before, Steve. It's a program that just doesn't go away. It just gets better just by thinking about it, talking about it, and looking at it.
You know, it's interesting because there's always been good television. I mean, people say that we go through these bad patches, but there's always something good to find. But, you know, there just seems to be something really special about the show, and we don't seem to get that kind of show anymore. And I was trying to figure this one out, and I talked to a lot of people about it, and there's something about the way Rod Serling wrote. He was a student of language, maybe the most precise speaker and writer we've ever had, certainly the most articulate speaker. And I think there was a small window in the late 50s and early 60s where Rod was able to translate these human interest stories about people, normal people, caught up in crazy situations. And with his mastering of this, of the dramatic force of his writing that he had developed in live television, there was just something amazing about these stories and how they were told. Today, you won't see these kinds of stories told because I think filmmakers and television producers are more into the visual. I don't think that you hear the kind of words that Rod created anymore.
No, you're right. It's all, you know, computer-generated graphics and high action. Where Serling, it was all about the theater of the mind and what he wrote. And he was a genius at that.
He was, and he was a very traumatized man. I mean, he was a patriotic man, and when the war broke out, World War II, he joined the paratroops. He barely got in because he was a rather short man, but he got into the paratroops, went over the Philippines, landed during the first waves there, and saw horror. And when he came out of the war, he had PTSD. Of course, it wasn't called that then. And he went to Chicago, and a therapist told him, you've got to channel this horror that you saw. And he channeled into writing.
He sure did. We have a mutual friend with Billy Ryback, the producer, one of the co-producers of Home Improvement, and the great writer himself. What a great guy. He's been in Hollywood a long time, Stephen, hasn't he?
Well, Billy and I are now writing together. We've been writing together for 3 years, and we've written 8 screenplays in the last 3 years. We're hoping to bring back family comedy to the film and television world.
That would be nice. And you know what? It would be different to bring back something for the family. My son and his little boy and his little daughter would love to have a program that everybody in the family can gather around and watch. So I hope that works for you, too.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the genesis of this book. We have been Twilight Zone fans for years. Years. Tell me about the growth of this book, The Twilight Zone Encyclopedia.
Well, like yourself and like many of the fans out there, we all love Mark Zucree's book. Now, Mark wrote the book, The Twilight Zone Companion, in 82,
yeah,
over 35 years ago. And that was the first time I'd ever seen anybody write something where it had all of the episodes, many of which I'd never seen, because I was 8 years old when the show appeared. I wasn't watching dramatic television in those days. I was watching cartoons almost nonstop. One night I walked into the living room, and my parents had on this episode with this strange scenario in a private club where a motor mouth can't stop talking, and this stuffy ex-colonel bets the guy $500,000 that he can't shut up for a year. And they place the guy in this glass cage in the basement. The episode was called The Silence, and I'm sitting there, and I'm scared. I'm just the Jesus scared on me, because the thought of, for an 8-year-old, of not being able to speak for a year was scary.
And did they put the guy in the cage, in the glass cage, for a year or just for a little bit?
For a year.
So I would have said that's a deal breaker. You know, maybe I'll try not to talk for a year, but I'm not going in some cage for a year.
Well, the prospect of he was not doing well financially, so the prospect of getting paid $500,000, and I won't spoil it for the viewers who haven't seen that episode.
Right.
Let's just say that it has a very, very, it has a very unusual twist, which, of course, was a hallmark of the series. So that was my first brush with the Twilight Zone. But, you know, I've had some success with my type of research. I started writing for CineFantastique back in the 70s. I was their 50s science fiction expert. I was doing behind-the-scenes retrospective articles long before the Internet, long before DVD special features on films like Forbidden Planet, The Day the Earth Stood Still, War of the Worlds, them. And I was finding the original people. I was writing about them. I was getting still cooperation from the studios, and I was getting a lot of attention for it. I later applied it to the James Bond movies. My encyclopedia did pretty well. And I'm looking at the number of books on the Twilight Zone, and I'm saying there may be an A to Z book here. I had collected a lot of research because there have been two biopics, one of which I developed myself at Showtime, on the life of Rod Serling, because I think his life is a very interesting one. And I decided that there's too much information that's not been imparted to the public. And as I told your producer, Tom, because he was asking me why we needed another Twilight Zone book, mm-hmm. I said, the people aren't being talked about enough. You know, it's all about Rod, of course, and maybe Matheson and Beaumont and George Clayton Johnson, right. Some of the high-profile actors. But there were hundreds and hundreds of people involved in the Twilight Zone, actors, supporting players, technicians. And they needed their place in history because this was MGM 1959, the relative epicenter of Hollywood. And it was the A-list of every performer, of the performers. And I think it was important to give these guys some historical stage. And plus, I'd collected a lot of behind-the-scenes information. And then I sought to interview everybody who was still alive with the show and find as much archival material as possible. So that's how the Twilight Zone Encyclopedia came together. It was a much bigger book at first because I went a little bit crazy.
It's pretty good size now.
Well, it's 438 packed pages with photos. It used to be 920 pages, but
wow.
I went a little overboard. I had biographies of everybody who uttered a line, and and then I had character bios of every character, and they said that it was information that was already in my mini synopses. By the way, I have all 156 episodes, but I don't give you the spoiler synopsis. I give you what I call the setup, because
right.
I think there are new generations of people who haven't seen Zones who really need to be allowed to see the shows before I give it away.
Didn't Rod Serling jumpstart the careers of a lot of people in the Twilight Zone series?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, the first name, of course, that comes to mind is Robert Redford. And
yeah.
Redford had actually made one of his first shows was a Playhouse 90 called In the Presence of Mine Enemies. It was one of the first Holocaust stories ever broadcast on national television. And Rod put him in the Twilight.
He was a police officer, if I remember, right?
Right. Exactly. Nothing in the Dark. It's one of those stories where the woman is, this older woman is in this tenement and she's terrified that the Angel of Death is going to track her down, and this policeman outside is wounded, and the question is, will she bring him in or not? And oof, it still gives me chills.
Oh, I know. It was, I remember that one. Billy Mumy, of course, one of our dear friends. I think Billy has been in four episodes, maybe?
Three.
Three episodes.
He was in this first episode, I believe, was the second season episode. It was called Long Distance Call. It was one of the videotaped episodes. James Aubrey, who was the president of CBS, basically didn't like the show and was doing all sorts of things to get rid of it. But Rod had a terrific contract, probably the first and maybe the last time in television history where somebody had total creative control.
That's right. He called the shots.
He called the shots. But Aubrey cut the budget in the second season. They had to film six of the 30-odd episodes in videotape. And that's unfortunate because the quality obviously hasn't been preserved as well as the film episodes. But Billy did that one. He did, of course, his most famous one, It's a Good Life. With
You're a bad, bad man.
You're a bad, bad, mad man, Anthony Fremont. And then he did the third, fifth season final episode he did In Praise of Pip, of course, with Jack Klugman.
Well, he also did, when they came out with a revival series, he also played an older person in It's Still a Good Life.
Right, and his daughter Liliana played the new generation.
That's right, and so that was the fourth one I was thinking about.
Right, exactly. And also, if we're talking about Billy Mumy and the Twilight Zone, he was in also in Twilight Zone, the movie. He had a small part in the remake of It's a Good Life that was shot by Joe Dante.
And from there, it jump-started his series Lost in Space, didn't it?
Yes. And, well, Billy was just one of the most adorable kids in Hollywood in the 50s, and I think that he, like Ronnie Howard, were just destined to have long careers in television.
Yeah.
And you know, there was such, what was interesting for me in interviewing a lot of the people was just learning little facts about their lives and, you know, what brought them to the zone and some of the things. I mean, Cliff Robertson, who was in two terrific episodes, he was in The Dummy, he played the ventriloquist, and then, of course, he's in that wonderful time travel episode, 100 Yards Over the Rim. They were bringing him out for one of those episodes, and they wanted to come out on a Friday.
Hold on for a second, Stephen. Let's pick that up when we come right back. Stephen Rubin, our guest, the Twilight Zone Encyclopedia, and we'll take your calls next hour. And welcome back, Stephen J. Rubin with us, his book, The Twilight Zone Encyclopedia. And Stephen, before we get into the Cliff Robertson story, people are emailing me. I assume you can get your book on Amazon, any other place?
Amazon, it's in all the stores. I'm actually doing some signings coming up on Monday. I'm in New York City at the Barnes & Noble in the Tribeca District at 6 p.m. That's on Monday the 6th. And then Friday the 10th, I'm going to be in Boston at the Prudential Center at 5:30, downtown Boston, also Barnes & Noble. And then on Monday, November 13th, I'm in Chicago at Volumes Book Cafe on Milwaukee Street at 7 p.m.
All great markets for us. Let's make sure we give out those locations again by the time you're done with us next hour.
You.
Okay, let's do that. So what was the Cliff Robertson story?
Well, Cliff was, you know, he'd done a bunch of shows by then, so he kind of knew the drill, and he said to them, you know, you want me to come out on a Friday, I understand, but you really only need me on Monday afternoon. So why don't I come out on Monday afternoon? So they changed his booking, and the airplane that he was going to fly in on crashed into the Hudson and killed everybody.
Oh, my gosh.
So, I mean, Cliff, that's the story there. Cliff, interestingly enough, on the night of 9/11, the day of 9/11, he was in a private plane over New York City within a hair's breadth of those jets. Asked to land. He had to land immediately at one of the airports. But talk about close calls. There are a lot of interesting stories about Twilight Zone performers who met shocking ends. This is another thing about when you start to dial down into the actual performers who were on those iconic episodes, you learn things like, for instance, Gig Young. Gig Young is in arguably one of the most poignant of all the episodes.
He was Zorro, wasn't he?
No, that was Guy Williams.
That's right. That's right.
Gig Young actually won an Oscar later on in the 60s for that that very very depressing movie. They shoot horses, don't they?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But he's in Walking Distance, which is a great episode about a burnt-out Manhattan advertising executive who visits his hometown when he stops off to get his car oil changed or something, and it's walking distance to his hometown, and he walks right through a warp, and all of a sudden it's 1935 again. He sees himself as a young boy, he sees his parents, and Gig was playing a very depressed man, and then later on in life, it reflected exactly what happened with him. He got very depressed, he married a young bride, murdered her, and committed suicide. It was just horrible.
Oh, my God. What happened to these people? I mean, was this a curse of the Twilight Zone, or what was it?
I don't think so, but there are there are 900 actors who were in the Twilight Zone. So you get a group of 900 people together, you're going to get some people who go through a bad patch. I mean, Albert Salmi, a wonderful character actor from the 50s and 60s, he was also in two memorable episodes. He plays a robber baron in of Cliffordville, who makes a pact with Julie Newmar as the devil to go back to his small town and remake his fortune. But he forgets one little detail, and of course it's a very Twilight Zone-y twist. And then he's in the episode Execution, where he's about to be hung in the Wild West, and a time machine hurdles him in, or a time traveler's invention hurdles him into the future, where he meets Russell Johnson, the time travel inventor. Anyway, he also committed suicide. I think also shot his wife and committed suicide. So these are terrible stories. And then there was one actor, I can't remember his name at the moment, but he went antique shopping in Morocco and was murdered by bandits. So, I mean, these are things that you hear that, well, my God. But it was important for me to kind of not only provide you with credits they were in, but tell you something about those other iconic roles they were in, because most of these actors either, as you point out, got their start with Rod, or were just burgeoning as the top character performers in the history of television and getting their first shot at actually playing a lead. I mean, Burgess Meredith, Jack Klugman, William Shatner were not exactly leading actors at that time.
No, that's true, too. Now, when you were compiling the book, The Twilight Zone Encyclopedia, obviously the episodes became your research projects. Was it hard or was it easy to put together the material from the TV shows?
Well, if you're a true historian and a researcher like myself, you have to know everything about everything. So I had to read literally everything I could find about the shows and all the books and all the research materials. But then I had to watch all 156 episodes a number of times, because I sit there with a legal pad and I make note of all the facts of the show, because sometimes those facts need to be defined, and a defined fact needs to be an encyclopedia entry. So at first I got a little nuts. I was starting to put down license plate numbers and telephone numbers, and I started to realize that I'm going a little too crazy. You know, there are various forms of trivia of aficionados. Some people dial down as far as how much lint is in somebody's pocket. But some people just need to know the key players and who they are, and as much behind-the-scenes information, which I tried to pack into the book because, you know, we've seen the episodes a number of times, but we need to know things perhaps that we didn't know. For instance, I didn't realize that the baseball episode, The Mighty Casey, which is Jack Warden plays the manager of the old Hoboken Zephyrs,
okay,
kind of a third-tier minor league ball club that's not doing well until a doctor brings his protege, a robot pitcher, played by Robert Sorrells. But Jack Warden was not the first actor in that episode. The episode originally starred Paul Douglas, the wonderful actor from the 50s, that big, gruff actor who was in a movie that inspired Rod Serling. It was called Angels in the Outfield.
Oh, that's
later
great.
Remade.
Great movie.
Great movie with Janet Leigh, yeah. And he played Guffey McGuffin, who was just a loudmouth guy, and Rod wrote a character named Mouth McGarry, who was basically right out of Guffey's terrain. But Paul was not well, and he finished the episode, and then he died literally the following week, and they looked at the dailies on the episode, and Paul didn't look good. He looked like he was dying in the episode.
Yeah.
So the network was just going to cancel that episode, and Rod Serling, out of his own pocket, spent something like $33,000 and recast the episode with Jack Warden playing McGarry. And they brought in a different director, and they redid it. And that's what Rod was really, really keen about, quality. You watch those 156 episodes in the row, you'll see probably, in terms of quality, the greatest television series in the history of mankind.
Yeah, there was no skimping in terms of writing or anything else. You'd get a kick out of this, Steve. I've got a letter in my office from the late Ray Bradbury, and he wrote the episode, I Sing the Body Electric.
Right.
And I had written an editorial about that. It was one of my favorite episodes. And he read it and just loved it and sent me a letter that I've got for the rest of my life. How cool is that, right? A letter from Ray Bradbury.
And that's so wonderful. I'm very envious because I'm a Ray Bradbury fan, as was Rod, by the way. And Rod's plan, by the way, as soon as he launched the show, was to hire Ray repeatedly. And the network was adamant that Rod had to write the majority of the shows. They spent a lot of money on his contract. And so Rod had to tell Ray, I really can't use you as much as I'd like. And they did the one episode together, although Ray had a little bit of a tiff with Rod about that episode. He thought he left out a salient element. So there was a little bit of a tiff, but Rod was a huge Ray fan. Now, how can you not?
And I got a little surprise for you, Stephen. Okay,
I'm
ready. Hello there, welcome to the show.
Well, hi there, you ancient alien.
All right, give us your favorite line from "It's a Good Life."
Don't make any noise when the music's playing.
No.
Hi, George.
Hello there, Bill. How are you?
I'm real good. Real good. How are you?
Stephen, we've got Billy Mumy on the line for you.
Well, I am thrilled to hear him, but I hear that he prefers Bill.
That's okay, Stephen. You've got one foot in the cornfield and one foot out of the cornfield. Don't worry.
Give us the bad, bad man line. Come on.
Call my agent, George.
Well, it's interesting that Bill's on the phone with us because I've been doing my daily blog. I've succumbed to being a Facebook blogger, and I have a thing now called the Twilight Zone Encyclopedia. I do this day in Twilight Zone history. And interestingly, that Bill should come on the show, and I'm on the show tonight. Today is the anniversary of the original 1961 airing of
It's a Good Life.
I love it.
Can you believe that that's 56 years? 56
Oh, my God, Bill.
Yeah, it's kind of creepy, huh?
It really is. Did Twilight Zone jumpstart your career, Bill?
No. I'd have to blame that on, the Loretta Young Show or Playhouse 90 or something like that. No, obviously the Twilight Zone was the three that I did. We're early on in my career, but I was definitely getting a few groovy roles.
Stephen, we've had a chance to have Bill on the program several times, and I'll always remember him telling me what it was like to be in school while he was doing these episodes and how the kids reacted to him. It was a good life, Bill, wasn't it?
It was indeed. And I'm one of those surviving human ex-child actors that I don't have any horror stories really beyond the scripts.
And Steve, before we let Bill go, it's late for him. Anything you want to ask him?
Well, first of all, Bill and I have a mutual friend. His name will remain nameless, but they lived on a street in West LA together. And I was listening to one of the commentaries Bill did, I think, for the television archives, and just funny stories of being. I think Bill, you were talking about being in the back of your mom's car, driving to the studio or driving from the studio when you were making It's a Good Life, and you kind of pictured using your power to change the signals, I believe.
Steve, you're good. You're good. Your memory is functioning like an excellent robot. Yes, that's totally true. I used to use Anthony's powers on the way back from Universal to Beverlywood, where we lived, and I would attempt to use Anthony's powers to keep the signals in our favor. That's very true.
Bill, you're one of our favorites in Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
Oh, gosh, I know that's familiar. Just give me a few minutes, and I'll try to come up with where I remember that one.
You're the best, my friend. Be well. Stay in touch, Bill.
Okay, Steve, good talking to you. George, hang tough, buddy.
You got it.
Thanks, Bill.
That's a neat little treat, isn't it?
Oh, God. You know, Bill is an icon. I mean, not only was he in wonderful television shows and movies, but he's a great musician, and a lot of people don't realize the bands he's been in and the songwriting skills he has. He's just such an eclectic guy, and there's so many people who are still around from the Twilight Zone. I was able to find people, and not necessarily the lead people, but people who had stories. For instance, I have a nice entry on Chuck Hicks, who's unknown to most people. Chuck Hicks played the robot boxer that boxes Lee Marvin in Steel, which is a great episode. Richard Matheson wrote that episode. And Chuck, was dealing with Lee Marvin and all the crazinesses of playing a robot with your eyes are covered with these plastic things to give you a robotic quality. And he was an ex-stuntman and ex-bit actor. And everybody had little stories. There was a lady who was in the miniature episode with Robert Duvall. That's the one where he plays this kind of square peg who's lonely, and he goes into a museum every day. He sees a little miniature house, and there's people in the house that come alive for him, and one of them was the little maid who was serving the lady who he falls in love with, and her name is Nina Roman, and she was standing in the back of the basement of the Ambassador Hotel on the day Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated.
Oh,
she claims to this day that she heard another gunshot from behind her, which would not have been Sirhan Sirhan. And,
well, a lot of people think that could have happened, that there were a number of different shots. As a matter of fact, just today, we're working on trying to get me to do an interview with Sirhan Sirhan. And
wow.
That would be historical indeed.
That would be historic. I mean, it's interesting how Rod Serling, had he lived beyond 1975, I think he would have probably done some JFK type stories. I mean, it's just kind of the things he got into. He was into conspiracies
yes.
and stuff like that. And one of his best feature screenplays, I always thought, was the wonderful adaptation of 7 Days in May. And that was a wonderful film. And Rod, you know, it's interesting, Rod's type of writing, as I mentioned earlier, was kind of going out of style. So, but that riveting dialogue, which was a hallmark of 7 Days in May, is just pure Rod Serling.
As a matter of fact, I think he would have loved coming on this program often, talking
oh, yeah.
about
well,
his
you know, work. Listen, if Rod Serling was around today, he'd have a lot to say about the modern condition.
Oh, my gosh, he sure would. I mean, now, so it's, you know, it's been, what, 60 years since The Twilight Zone and the impact of The Twilight Zone. How appropriate is it today? Is it just as poignant and strong?
Well, if you watch the shows, you're seeing very contemporary issues dealt with in the world of science fiction. I think that that was another thing about The Zone. Yes, there were some very entertaining shows, but a lot of them had that moral dilemma, the thing that, whether it was an issue. And by the way, this is late 50s TV, early 60s. Controversy, every network executive was allergic to it, so they didn't do controversial episodes. You know, they stayed away from it. I mean, Rod tells a story over and over again. He wanted to tell the Emmett Till story in when he was doing live television in New York. You know, the black teenager who was whistling at a white woman, and he was hung.
Yeah, crazy stuff. Oh,
crazy
my God. What times?
And a network executive actually said to him, you can make the story as long as you make him a Mexican. And Rod was outraged by something like that. And, you know, there's other stories. The story of if you were having a cavalry Western and the show was sponsored by Chevrolet, the cavalry commander could not say, we're going to ford that river. It was just ridiculous.
He was so socially responsible. One of the few people in that era, of course, you know, Hollywood generally is, in some cases, in those days, pretty responsible. But he was right at the forefront for doing things like that.
He was one of the first people that protested the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
I mean, when it was not, you know, not fashionable to do that. And I think that, he was very well read. And I think that, again, he was so articulate. I mean, he would be probably a regular person on a show like Nightline in the 90s or on, you know, one of the CNN or
mm-hmm.
shows talking about issues because they were very important. And I think he really felt the moral responsibility of the television medium. I mean, he in this possible biopic on the film that we were developing at Showtime, he talks about the fact that he was so frustrated because for the first time in the history of mankind, you had the ability to reach tens of millions of people at once with a message. And what was television doing at the time? They had wrestling and Gunsmoke and game shows.
Yeah.
And, you know, the same detective movie 12,000 times. So he saw a great opportunity for television to make an impact on society. And, you know, to a certain extent, it's very true. But I think that television has a tendency sometimes to travel in the mundane and forget that we have this ability to change people's lives with the shows we broadcast.
Steve, I don't think I can pick a favorite Twilight Zone episode. I think I could honestly say I liked all of them that I saw. I'm pretty sure I saw most of them when I was a kid, and I've got the DVD series now. But I liked them all.
It's very hard, and you know, you kind of have such a selection. I mean, there of the 156, I would say at least 30 to 35 are some of the best shows ever broadcast in the history of television, just in terms of not only entertainment value, but just the impact they had. And you know, some of them are a little goofy and fun. I mean, I don't think the strong suit of The Twilight Zone was comedy, but I'll tell you what they did do really well. They really tackled time travel. I mean, time travel is such a interesting concept, and some of the best episodes had to deal with the concept of time travel. And most people don't realize that The Zone was born because he sold a one-hour drama to Westinghouse Desilu Playhouse called The Time Element with William Bendix. And that was a story of a New York bartender who every night went to sleep and dreamt he was at Pearl Harbor the day before the attack and can't convince anybody that there's going to be this horrific attack. And the mail for that episode of Westinghouse Desilu Playhouse was so intense.
Oh, it really was. Steve, we're going to come back. We're going to talk more about the Twilight Zone Encyclopedia, and this time we'll open up the phone lines to give you an opportunity to chime in.